We're going to switch gears right now and bring on someone who is no stranger to Science Friday, Dr. Henry Petrosky. He's an author of many, many books, and he deals in with product design. How many times, for example, have you handled, you sat in, drove, pushed, you pulled, you dragged, or dropped an object you wished was designed better? Ugh, it's happened to me, certainly. How many times have you looked at an object, say a toothbrush, and wondered, what the heck was on the mind of the designer who felt he needed to place a racing stripe down the side of my Oral-B? I mean, what is that for? How many times have you peeled a potato or a carrot or one of these, you know, using these newfangled fat-handled potato peelers? You say, yeah, you know, it feels great in my hand, but I can't see the spuds I'm peeling. You know, I can't pull those eyes out anymore. I don't know where they are. Perhaps you've said to yourself, hey, you know, for the money they pay these folks, I could design a much better widget. Let me go one step further. When you found out that the foam that crashed into the doomed space shuttle had ripped off many times in many previous flights, did you find yourself asking, what was on the minds of those engineers who knew about it but didn't consider it to be dangerous? Well, my next guest has considered the toothbrush, the pencil, and the space shuttle, and he has been called the poet laureate of technology, and his books on the design and evolution of everyday objects have no doubt inspired many people to stop and take note of subjects that suddenly don't seem so ordinary. Henry Petrosky is the Alexander S. Vesic Professor of Civil Engineering and Professor of History at Duke University, and his latest book is Small Things Considered. I wonder where Henry got that name, Small Things Considered, just out by Knopf. He joins us from Duke campus in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Petrosky.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
I like that name, Small Things Considered.
Yes, it sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It's a nice ring to it. And I want to thank you because at the beginning of the book, you mentioned Science Friday. I think you've taken all your material for your book from Science Friday.
Well, you gave me plenty of good starting material for this book. That's certainly true.
One of the points you make in the book is that there's no such thing as perfect design. I mean, we're seeking perfection, but you can't have it. Talk about that.
Well, that's right. That's right. The whole idea of design is to come up with something, either a device or a process or an event that really is a lot of things to a lot of people, that fits in a lot of hands or will, you know, entertain a diverse group of people. Because we're trying to do so much with even the simplest things, we find ourselves frustrated in trying to do everything perfectly. So we end up compromising. The potato peeler that you mentioned, the idea was to make it fit arthritic hands, but for those who don't have arthritis, the thing feels a little bit awkward sometimes, a little bit maybe too fat. So there are trade-offs in design, and the idea is to reach a happy medium, but whenever that's the goal, then the people on the extremes, at least, are going to be disappointed.
1-800-989-8255 if you would like to talk with Henry Petrosky. You wrote an editorial for the New York Times examining the culture of NASA after the shuttle disaster and regarding the persistent lack of concern in NASA's culture. Perhaps NASA could be better understood, you wrote, by examining the culture that rises from the inevitable and healthy tension among scientists, managers, and engineers. What did you mean by that?
Well, this is really another design problem. The shuttle itself is obviously a very complicated piece of machinery that had to be designed, and a lot of compromises had to be made. The materials had to be as light as possible and yet at the same time be as strong as possible. Well, those are often competing objectives. So meeting a happy medium is necessary in order to get the thing to fly, but it leaves vulnerabilities, as the accident demonstrated. At the same time, the space shuttle itself is embedded in a much larger system, which, again, is a design, the idea of when to launch, how to launch, under what conditions, and so forth and so on. And then still further, there's this human design, this human system of engineers and managers and scientists. The engineers would like the perfect vehicle, if at all possible, which I claim is not, but they'd like it to be as close to perfection as possible. But their objectives are different from those of the scientists. The scientists would like to carry up equipment such as telescopes and so forth that are as heavy as possible. The managers want to do it as cheaply as possible. All these conflicting objectives necessarily lead to compromises, to choices among opposites, incompatibles. The whole system can work if everybody recognizes this and becomes critical of the pressures that necessarily result. In the case of the space shuttle, as we saw with the Challenger and again with the Columbia, little things are going wrong all the time. In the case of the Challenger, it was the O-rings. In the case of the Columbia, it was this foam. Because these things tend to happen a lot, they tend to become ordinary, and they tend not to be paid as much attention to. They tend to be not as criticized as perhaps they should, and we've seen the results.
Mm-hmm. And we hear now that the shuttle was never supposed to be considered, you know, something other than still in the testing process. It was still too new.
Well, some people maintain that's right. But at the same time, it was clearly an operational vehicle, and it was supposed to have regular takeoffs and returns.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Henry Petrosky, who is joining us to talk about design. He is certainly someone who knows a lot about design, written many books about it. We're going to have to take a short break and come back and let you talk to Henry about maybe you have some ideas of great design, poor design. I know Henry hears a lot about poor design all the time, so it'll be nothing new, and maybe we'll give him some topics for his next book. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about design and engineering, where there is no perfect design, with my guest Henry Petrosky, professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University in North Carolina, author of Small Things Considered, and our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Scott in St. Louis. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Okay. Just a short comment. I think I run into this all the time, that it doesn't seem that anybody who designed and developed the product ever tried to change the oil or work on the thing, and constantly having trouble. That it just doesn't seem like they
ever used it. Well, we lost him, Henry.
Yes. Well, that's
is that really true, or does it just seem that way?
Well, it certainly seems that way, and in some cases it might be true. The problem is, I think, that designers are human beings too, and when they are so engaged in the design of something, and they might be fighting to make it fit into an engine compartment, if it's an automobile engine, let's say, they tend to get distracted, let's say, by certain things, like making sure that the oil cools the engine and lubricates the engine, whereas the user of the vehicle who wants to maintain it and change the oil now and then is a different individual. It typically is the case that designers aren't the end user in the same way that somebody who buys the product cold without having gone through the design process is. Mm-hmm. And it is also the case that when somebody is engaged in design and it becomes myopic about the system that is being designed and tends to learn all the tricks about, say, how to change the oil. If you know the tricks and you know exactly how to put your hands or your tools into the right places at the right angles, it'll work.
Yeah.
But if you happen to be a little, have a heavier hand or a broader fist, it might not work as easily.
I know you get a lot of mail from all your books about things that are wrong, that designed poorly. Is there one thing that stands out in all your mail about, gee, this thing really is awful?
I wouldn't say there's one thing that stands out. There certainly are classes of things. Things in automobiles fall into a class that is commonly complained about. A lot of people have been complaining to me lately about cup holders in their automobiles. I heard from a colleague just last week that his wife was shopping for a new car, and she had narrowed it down to a half dozen or so, and she really couldn't distinguish between the cars very much. They all had pretty much the same features, but the cup holders were significantly different, and it was the cup holder that ended up being her choice of the determining factor in her choice of automobile.
That's interesting, and then the marketing people taking notes on those sorts of things, I'm sure. You devote, this really interesting part of your book, Small Things Considered, you devote quite a few pages to that pizza thingy, that little table that keeps the cheese from sticking to the box, a little separator. Why is that so fascinating to you?
Well, it's fascinating to me because it's been fascinating to readers and listeners of radio shows I've been on.
Uh-huh.
The fact of the matter is it's a rather elegant design for solving a messy problem. The problem, of course, as most people are aware, is if you order a pizza delivered or bring one home in a cardboard box, that sometimes if the car bounces over a rough road on the way home, the cheese of the pizza is no longer on the pizza, but it's on the top lid of the box. So in order to prevent that from happening, and this is where most designs come from, they're really to prevent something from happening rather than really affect something, somebody invented this a little plastic thingy, as you refer to it, that has three little legs, and it sits on the pizza and therefore disturbs it in a minimal way. And then on the top there's a platform that keeps the lid from coming down and touching the pizza, and at the same time keeps the pizza from, you know, jumping up and bouncing against the top. It's a wonderful solution for what could be a very, very annoying problem.
It's a little like a little round coffee table, like a miniature
doll's house coffee. Yes, you could say that. Yes, it comes in various models. It's officially by its manufacturer called a pizza saver.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, most things do have an official name, but most of us don't know them. Because we generally, you know, we don't order these things. They just come with the pizza.
Yeah, well, you're going to call the manufacturer and you say, send me 100,000 of those pizza thingies. What do you call them? You have to have a real name for it. I'm sorry,
well,
you have to say one woman. One woman what? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
One woman wrote about saving these things. Whenever they came with the pizza, she would wash them off and throw them in a drawer because she thought there's going to be a use for these things. They're just so clever. And what she ended up using them for was, if you turn them upside down, the three legs stick up like prongs, and she could put an egg on there and paint it or decorate it as she was wont to do. She also described that actually these things are amazingly expensive for the little amount of plastic that's used in making them, such a simple design. And she concluded that the reason they were so expensive was that the packaging is very expensive because they're wrapped, they're packaged in a box that also has a pizza on it, on the bottom of it, to protect this plastic thing in transit.
Do you have anything a favorite or a pet object that you really like the design of? You know, that's a pleasure to use.
Well, I think a lot of things are a pleasure to use. Certainly the plastic bottle is a pleasure to use, but it also has a lot of its annoyances. This comes back to the theme of nothing's perfect. When I was a kid, we used to carry our water around in old surplus army surplus canteens that were metal and
had a few of those.
Were heavy, heavy and noisy and got rusty. The plastic bottle is a lot more sanitary. It's lighter. But of course, being so light as it is, and being an attempt to manufacture it as inexpensively as possible, the idea is to use the least amount of plastic, it seems, and sometimes it almost appears to fall apart in your hands.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Sunnyvale, California. Hi, Theo.
How are you guys doing?
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
Hi.
I've had an idea milling around my head for quite a while. Basically, it incorporates feng shui into design, almost like a spell check on a, you know, computer. But you would maybe set up some type of, I don't know if algorithm's the right.
Yeah, we lost him. I hope. What do you think about, where he was headed? Feng shui and...
He was probably headed somewhere where his cell phone didn't work.
I think so.
I honestly don't know exactly where he was headed with the idea.
Oh, that's too bad. Let's see if we can go get another phone call. Let's go to Carl in Phoenix. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
Good. As you were talking about before about the idea of trying to satisfy many different needs in the designs of things.
I think we're just having phone system problems today. We'll have to see. I think we're having,
yes,
you know.
The cell phone is wonderful
phone
until
systems
it does
working.
This.
let me ask you about some other stuff that's in your book. One of the things that I've always noticed, and I'm glad you bring this up in your book, is the keypad cells of a cell phone and a calculator are just about opposite. One has the numbers on the top, one has the numbers on the bottom. Why would you purposely do that?
Well, there are theories, speculations. It seems strange that anybody would deliberately do that, but the idea seems to have been that when the push-button telephone was introduced, the telephone company had to make a choice about how the numbers would be arranged, how the buttons would be arranged, and in what order. They ended up with the rectangular matrix design that we're all so familiar with, and put the numbers 1, 2, 3 across the top because the old dial phone started out 1, 2, 3 and then wrapped around. Calculator manufacturers, on the other hand, came from a different tradition, and the tradition there was closest to the cash register, where the lower numbers were on the bottom and they increased in a somewhat logical, visually logical way. So the calculators were designed with the number pad in the opposite direction. What I think is especially interesting about this distinction is we human users have virtually no trouble going from a calculator on our desk to the telephone on our desk and being able to use them equally deftly, even though they are, have this opposite order. I don't remember ever myself thinking that when I was dialing the phone that I was using a calculator or vice versa. Yeah. I think what this shows is that the human, we humans are able, we have an infinite capacity, it seems, to adapt to technology. Technology doesn't rule us. We really, have control over it, and it can't outsmart us, ultimately, or trip us up. We are able to jiggle all sorts of different remote control devices, for example, that have much more than numbers on them, and we're able to figure them out. And also we're able to ignore the parts of them that we are not interested in or that, admittedly, sometimes we can't figure out, but see no need to because the television or the VCR or DVD is working as we want it to.
Is there ever a design that sort of wins out over the others by just sheer force of numbers, where you have competing? And I'm not talking about Betamax versus, VHS and things like that. But,
well, that's what came to my mind.
let me just bring up something that's in your book. I was thinking you have a chapter called Kitchen Sink Design, and you talk about the Moen faucet there.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, the original kitchen design was, having the two separate knobs or taps and then combining them together. But there are still some places, I think you mentioned the Great Britain, that resists, having that one single faucet.
Well, that's right. Design has a strong cultural component, and some cultures, in this case Britain, just prefer to go more slowly in changing from what they have been used to. The fact of the matter is that they probably are able to predict more readily how their water is going to come out of the faucet because they've been using faucets of the same kind for so long. Whereas anybody that's traveled around hotels in this country knows that you can get into a shower and be very confused about exactly how to turn it on, which way is hot, which way is cold, and so forth and so on.
And even worse, how to get the water to come out of the shower head. You ever been
yes.
You can't figure out what is the button you twist to get it to go from going out the bottom and coming out the shower head on top. I've stood there for 20 minutes sometimes, and I'm a pretty handy guy trying to figure this out. Yeah. Is it just me or is it everybody?
once we do figure it out, we say, oh, well, it is obvious in retrospect. I've been in a lot of hotels where there was actually a sign pasted in the shower explaining how to operate it, which is a clear sign of a design failure because the design of something so seemingly simple as a shower control device should be self-evident about how it works.
Do designers think that that's their competitive advantage? I mean, why doesn't an industry get together and agree on something Is it purely because of the aesthetic value that they want to change? That it looks prettier, or what is it?
Well, it's not always just so simple as that. In some cases, there are reasons for doing it differently in order to get around patents. Some device might be patented, and in order to not be accused of violating the patent rights of the owner, another company that wants to compete in that marketplace might have to make changes that might not necessarily be for the better, but they are to escape really being sued for infringing on the patent.
We're talking about design this hour at Henry Petrosky on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, author of Small Things Considered. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-989-8255. We have gremlins in our phone system today. So let's see if we can get Theo back from Sunnyvale, if he's still there. Hi, Theo.
Hi, guys. Had to call back.
See if you can do it quickly in case we drop your line again.
Sure. Basically, it was using feng shui as a template for design so that you could maybe... it's a tough one for me to pull out of my head here, but if feng shui is basically a positive flow, that things are going to work better and be more positive influence, then why not use that as a template for how things are designed, like floor plans in buildings or the shape of something, you know, a couch or various things like that.
Well, you have to believe that works then. Just you take that as a given that it's...
Well, I think there might be a way to quantify some of those theories or the concept of feng shui and bring it, you know, and put right. some quantifiable science to it.
All right, let's see if Henry has an idea there. Henry?
Well, I'm generally skeptical of one size fits all, whether it be in design or gloves or anything else. I think Albert Einstein looked for a theory of everything in a sense, and even he was frustrated. Design covers such a broad spectrum of things that to expect that one formula or one method would apply equally well to such diverse things as say the layout of a supermarket and the design of a paperclip. Is probably asking a little too much of a simple method. The method might get increasingly complicated, and you know maybe eventually it would cover more and more things, but at the price of complexity.
Mm-hmm. One of the favorite things that you mentioned in your book is the design of toothbrushes, and I certainly when I at the top of the show when I said I got this toothbrush with a racing stripe and molt in it, it had all kinds of curves and stuff on the handle. What are they thinking there? I mean, what does it have to do with the teeth part of the brush?
Well, not very very much, of course.
What and it doesn't, is, and it doesn't even fit in the toothbrush holder, you know?
Well, that's a different question. So the racing stripe is sort of decorative. In some cases, it's functional if it's made of a different material that assists the grip. But generally, things like toothbrushes are trying to distinguish themselves from each other so that when you go to the drugstore to buy a new toothbrush, something with a racing stripe stands out, especially if it's an odd color, as they seem to be in so many cases. The fact of the matter is that the fat handles that don't fit into toothbrush holders are actually a good development in that they are more what designers call ergonomic. They mm-hmm. they work better in the hand. I personally like the fatter handle. It's something more substantial to hold, and it's easier to turn around and use in all sorts of different orientations. And that was the driving force behind developing that style of handle. The fact that it did not fit into standard toothbrush holders presented a problem for manufacturers. Some of them decided, well, we're going to go with it anyway. Even if people can't fit these into their holders, we believe that the ergonomic advantage far outweighs mm-hmm. The fact that the toothbrush is not going to fit the existing infrastructure, if you will. Mm-hmm. But again, people are clever, and a woman...
Let me hold that story, because we have to take mm-hmm. a break, and we'll find out the end of the mystical toothbrush story from Henry Petrosky. Author of Small Things Considered. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A brief program note, Neil Conan is back on Monday, and he's talking with Simon Winchester about the passion, suspense, and quirky characters that went into the making of the first Oxford English Dictionary. That's on Talk of the Nation on Monday. We're talking this hour about design and engineering and why there is no perfect design with my guest, Henry Petrosky, professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University, North Carolina, author of Small Things Considered, our number 1-800-989-8255. Henry, you can finish your story about the woman's solution she had to this fat toothbrush that doesn't fit in the holder.
Well, like a lot of us, she kept her toothbrushes in a different way. In her case, she put them in a plastic tumbler on her sink. But rather than being frustrated that she has this toothbrush holder built into her ceramic tile bathroom that is not serving any function anymore, she began to put her rings and jewelry up there when she was washing up. It's interesting that, you know, things evolve like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's possible that 50 years down the line, when all toothbrushes are fat and none fit into those built-in holders anymore, that people will look at houses and buy them and call that a jewelry holder.
Speaking of interesting design about rings, my wife has one of these little model hands that, you know, you put by the sink if you're washing dishes or something. It's like a plastic hand. You take your rings off and you stick them on the fingers. I think that's a great, simple idea for design.
Yes, and the way you describe it, it's so suggestive of what its purpose is, too.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned in your book I thought was fascinating is that you talk about how science follows engineering, and engineering can come first, whether it's the steam engine, whether it's the space shuttle. Engineers design it, and then scientists later try to figure out how it works or why it works.
Well, that's right. Something like the steam engine or the airplane. We're celebrating the 100th mm-hmm. anniversary of the Wright brothers this year. And the Wright brothers, they couldn't go to a library and get the books that told them how to design an airplane. There were no airplanes, and there were not going to be books to tell them how to do it, therefore. They had to figure it out themselves. That's not to say that they didn't rely on some science. They did. But there wasn't a body of science that we today call aerodynamics that explains how airplanes fly and can make fine distinctions about whether the wings should look like this or like that. It was only after the airplane began to be developed, and clearly the design of the Wright brothers had worked, that people tried to improve it. Since there is no perfect design, the Wright brothers' plane was certainly not perfect. A lot of improvement follows. As we know, there are a lot of different airplane designs today. And it's there that the science becomes refined and increasingly sophisticated to make increasingly minor changes to improve, say, the efficiency or the speed or the economy of an airplane or any other design.
1-800-989-8255. And they're still arguing these days about why an airplane flies, whether you want to explain it the Bernoulli way or the Newton way. And there's a tremendous amount of debate about which way is the best way to explain it. Let's go and explain it. Let's go to John in Havana, Florida. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Where is Havana?
Hi.
Right near Tallahassee.
All right.
Right up near the Georgia border.
Great. Have you got a question for us?
I got a comment.
Okay.
I'm an instructor teacher, and I go in and out of lecture halls frequently. And one of the most frustrating things is that the switches on the wall that control the lights have no relationship whatsoever to which lights are turned off and on, and they're different room from room. So you end up trying everything, trying to figure out how to turn off the one light that's in front of the board or how to turn right. it on and so on. There's no standard.
Well, that's right, and it's especially frustrating if there's a time delay, as there is in a lot of hotels where they have energy-efficient bulbs. So you flip the switch, nothing happens, and you think, well, that's not the switch. So you turn it back off. But that was the switch. You just didn't wait long enough for the lights to come on. Donald Norman has written a lot about the positioning of light switches, and he has been talking and writing about that frustrating problem for some years in a rather eloquent way.
Mm-hmm. I know you wrote a book a few years ago called Engineers of Dreams, Great Bridge Builders and the Spanning of America, so we thought we'd for the last few minutes we have, we bring another guest help you pick your brain with his brain. Let me introduce my guest. Charles Syme is a structural engineer and vice president of T.Y. Lin International in San Francisco. He joins us by cell phone. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Syme.
Yes, I'm glad to be here.
Bridge are you currently working on? I know you're a bridge designer, and I know that there's been talk about actually designing a bridge that will span, 19 miles across the Rock of Gibraltar? Is that correct?
Well, the official distance is 14 kilometers, which is about 10 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But the main spans are 5,000 meters, which translates to 16,500 feet, and that's a little over 3 miles per span.
You
add those two together, you get six, and then you add some more for the side spans, and you eventually span the whole crossing.
Is this something actually in the works, or just sort of being thought about?
It's being thought about. There's a consortium between Morocco and Spain that's been formed. They're headquartered in Madrid. And they looked at the bridges. Right now, I think they're looking at tunnels. But I think the bridge will come back after they examine the cost and capacity of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. What do you think was the toughest technological challenge of any bridge in the world that has been built? Charles, are you there?
Yes, I didn't hear the question, please.
I said, what was the toughest bridge to build? And I'll ask this of Henry also, what he thinks.
Yes, all the big bridges are tough to build. Brooklyn Bridge has been well documented as being very, very difficult. And that was opened in 1883. But Eads, who built the Eads Bridge in St. Louis, and that was opened in 1874, almost 10 years earlier, had a very difficult time, particularly with the pneumatic caissons. So they're all difficult, but in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Henry, do you have a favorite bridge that was particularly challenging to engineers?
Well, as Chuck indicates, a lot of bridges have been challenging. Very often the most challenging bridge is the one that's currently under construction. Because there are always unique problems to be solved. There are unique challenges to be met. And the bridges that have not yet been built, in large part have not yet been built because those technological challenges have yet to be met. This putting a bridge over the Strait of Gibraltar, for example, will require, bold new developments in engineering and technology. As far as favorite bridges are concerned, I also, have a lot of favorites because I like bridges generally. But certainly, the Brooklyn Bridge is one of my favorites. Not only because of the great drama of the story that of its building, but also the fact that it has a wonderful pedestrian walkway. Walking across the Brooklyn Bridge from Brooklyn to Manhattan is one of the great pedestrian experiences in the world. And to be able to, especially in the evening at sunset, see the sun setting behind the skyscrapers in Lower Manhattan is mm-hmm. just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Now that must be a design element that is thought of early in the design process, right?
Well, yes, it has to be because the details of design follow only after that concept is laid out. John Roebling, who was the designer, the conceptual designer of the Brooklyn Bridge, very consciously did put a pedestrian walkway there. And not only did he put a walkway on the bridge, but he located it in a very thoughtful way. It's raised above the traffic. So even today, when you walk across the Brooklyn Bridge, the traffic is below you. It doesn't interfere with your line of sight looking either upriver or downriver. And also because you're above it, it's not as loud as it might be, say, on the Golden Gate Bridge, where you're at the same level as mm-hmm. the traffic.
Who makes that decision, whether to make it a pedestrian-friendly bridge? Is it the designer or is it the city that says, this is what I want my bridge to do?
Well, these days it tends to be a decision involving many people. There's a bridge that is up in Maine, the Waldo Hancock Bridge, which is along the coast of Maine, and it was recently found to be in very poor repair. And there's an emergency need for a new bridge, a replacement bridge, to be built, designed and built within a matter of really 2 or 3 years. It's that urgent. And there is a large number of people that are engaged in making the decisions about whether the bridge should have a pedestrian walkway or a bicycle path, how many lanes, what it should look like, and so forth and so on. There's another bridge in Washington, D.C., on Interstate 95. It's the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. It's a drawbridge that goes across the Potomac. Most people don't ever experience it going up or down because they only do that in the middle of the night, generally speaking. But there is a lot of citizen consultation going on in the design details of that bridge. Much of this consultation is over now because it's been going on for years. But the public had a lot to say about what the final design of that bridge is like.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Henry Petrosky and Charles Syme this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And we're going to say goodbye to Charles Syme. Hey, we're having terrible phone problems today, and I think his cell phone is not working too well. So we'll bring him back on when we get a better connection in a future Science Friday. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to, how about Kevin in Portland. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
I wanted to ask about the Segway. It was just generally as a design. What is your opinion on the design of the Segway? It was introduced with so much hype. It was going to revolutionize the way we move through the world. And, you know, lately it's been recalled for safety. And I never got to get one because it was $5,000. But generally, what do you think of it?
Yeah, why? Interesting idea. What happened?
Yes, well, the Segway, the so-called human transporter, is really a wonderful idea. I mean, the technology involved, the originality, and so forth. There's a book recently published about it that tells the story wonderfully. But the reason the Segway is so interesting is because it has so many dimensions to it. Here is a thing with two wheels that you ride on. It almost looks like you're riding a lawnmower
those push mowers, yeah.
Yeah, to be honest about it. But it's hard to imagine it having a different configuration. The Segway people were very thoughtful in saying that, you know, because this is so different, it might not be readily accepted by communities. It might be outlawed, for example. So in a very interesting way, they actually tried to preempt that from happening by really lobbying for laws in local communities to allow this device to be used on sidewalks, whereas if they had not done that in anticipation, they might have lost every opportunity for it to happen, because invariably there are going to be accidents with this thing. And if in fact the Segway company allowed just events to take to run their course, it's very possible that a lot of communities would have would have outlawed the device, the use of the device, and that would have obviously been disastrous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think they'll be improved? And if so, what improvements can you see?
Well, without question, they'll be improved. I believe everything will be improved, at least up to a point, at which time it starts deteriorating again. But in the case of the Segway, I think the appearance might change a little bit. To give it a more style, let's say. I think it lacks a little bit of style now. I also think that some of the safety devices will probably be improved. This recall, for example, highlights a potential safety problem about allowing the battery to run too low under certain conditions.
Sure.
As people use these things and as consumers give more and more feedback through use that might not have been anticipated by the designers, there will be subtle changes.
All right. Henry, I've got to say goodbye. We've run out of time. It's a subtle change I have to make. Thanks for coming on. Good luck to you.
Thanks very much.
Henry Petrosky, professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University. His new book is Small Things Considered, published by Knopf. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York, Cabell Smith and James Todd in Durham. Greg Smith composed our theme music. If you missed any of the references, go to sciencefriday.com. You can leave us email there. You can get Science Friday's Kids Connection, which is free. Teaching curricula for your classrooms. Also, you can download Science Friday onto your audible.com player and also listen to it on Real Audio. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.